and welcome to Parkinson's Life, the award-winning podcast offering a voice to the global Parkinson's community. Each episode, we bring together people impacted by the condition for an honest conversation to share their stories, perspectives, and ideas on how to live well with Parkinson's. In this episode, two guests discuss everything there is to consider when making the decision about deep brain stimulation, or DBS. Here to tell us all about her experience is Kathy Mullahan, an Irish-born Parkinson's campaigner based in Germany. Diagnosed with the condition in 2012, Kathy underwent DBS surgery nearly 2 years ago to address issues with tremor. Joining her is neurosurgeon Kiomars Ashkan from the UK, who is professor of neurosurgery at King's College Hospital in London. With many years' experience supporting patients through DBS, he shares his own perspective on how to prepare for the surgery. This episode was funded by Medtronic, a medical device company working on groundbreaking healthcare technology solutions for the most complex and challenging conditions.
So my name is Kathy Mullahan. I come from Ireland, but I've been living in Germany for, over half my life now. Came here as a student and kind of got stuck in Germany a good while ago. So love living here, but I am a very proud Irish woman as well. And I was diagnosed with Parkinson's 10 years ago. Major shock at the time, but it changed my life, as you guys can imagine, for bad mostly, but for some good as well. I think we can chat about that a little bit later, maybe. And I'm here today to just chat about having DBS surgery, which I did a year and a half ago.
So my name is Kiomars Ashkan. I'm professor of neurosurgery at King's College Hospital, which is a large hospital in London. And my main specialties, or one of my main specialties, is deep brain stimulation, which is a topic we're going to be talking about today. So I've been a neurosurgeon for, finished training almost 20 years ago, and I've been a professor for almost half of that time. So I've been in this business, if you like, for a very long time. I'm also lucky to be the president of British Society for Functional Neurosurgery, which is a society that takes care of deep brain stimulation and, you know, promotes the ethos and looks after the patients who are those who require this kind of surgery.
How did you become a neurosurgeon? Like, how does one decide to start in a career path that involves, as far as I'm concerned, and correct me if I'm wrong, cutting open people's skulls quite regularly and having a look at their brain?
Well, I think there are essentially two different paths to become a neurosurgeon, at least in my opinion anyway. I guess you got those people who are committed surgeons. So what they primarily enjoy is, as you put it, is cutting through, brain tissue, if you like, and the skull, if you like. The second type of neurosurgeons are those whose primary interest is neurosciences. So what they're really interested is to understand the brain function, and they have commitment to treat patients with brain disorders. And out of all the different disciplines of neuroscience, for example, I chose to do neurosurgery rather than neurology because I find it very gratifying to be able to serve patients with brain conditions and see the, you know, fantastic outcomes that one can achieve. Not always, but, you know, feasible in a significant majority of patients.
It's fascinating to hear, you know, and I think what you said resonates with me a lot, because you can imagine the decision to have deep brain stimulation is not taken lightly. You know, I read somewhere that deep brain stimulation, you have somebody cutting through your skull, inserting electrodes into your brain. And how it all actually works is a bit fuzzy. Maybe we can go back to that in a minute. And for me, choosing to do this in the first place and then where to do this was a huge decision. And I chose where to go by the people, basically. I talked to several neurosurgeons, and some of them, to be honest, I didn't like very much. I found them a bit I couldn't relate to them. And my way of thinking was, if I'm going to have surgery where I'm lying awake for maybe 4 or 5 hours, 8 hours on a table, I want to be able to relate to this person. It might sound silly, but it was super important to me. So when you said, you know, that you're committed to serving patients and to working with brain diseases and to understanding what's going on in the brain, that for me would be a huge marker in choosing a surgeon to operate on me. And I chose the surgeon who operated on me because a good friend of mine had his operation in the same clinic and said, listen, these guys are good. I've done the research, but these guys are also human and they'll have a laugh with you while you're lying there with them poking things in your head, you know? And that was a big factor. Would you agree with that, KMRs? I mean, what's it like for you on the other side?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think you got it in one. Neurosurgery in the form of deep brain stimulation, and bear in mind, Parkinson's disease is a chronic condition, right? It's not something that happens there and then and ends. It's a chronic condition. So the treatment, therefore, is not an episode. It is something that has got duration, and therefore it's like a commitment. It's like a long-term commitment. So the surgical team that you enter into a contract with, so the surgical team that you decide to have the operation under, and that surgical team is not just a neurosurgeon, it's a neurologist, neuropsychologist, the whole team, a clinical nurse specialist, you are in it for the long haul. So you need to be able to get on with them, because if you don't, it's not as if you're going to go to a shop. And if you don't like that shop, you're never going to go again. That's it. That's not it. Once you enter into that relationship, and that relationship, I use the term relationship very, very much on purpose, is there for life. If you don't, you know, like the people that you're dealing with, then to be honest, you know, even if they're the best surgeons on the planet or the best technical team, you're not going to get that kind of satisfaction, and you're not going to actually potentially get better, because mind and body work together. And if you're not comfortable in your interactions with your treating team, no matter how wonderful the electrodes are placed, actually the outcome is not going to be as good as if you get on with the team and you know that they got, you know, they're looking at you as a human being rather than a brain that needs surgery, then that is going to directly influence the outcome. So I think you've done well by, you know, taking your time and looking to see who it is that you want to work with long term.
It's wonderful that you bring that up, KMRs, because, you know, it's something that myself and quite a lot of people in the Parkinson's community, and not only Parkinson's, all chronic diseases, are kind of fighting to get draw attention to the fact that, yes, we are patients, but we're also people. And we have a story and we have a history and we have hopefully a future. And, you know, the again, coming back to the choice of which surgeon, there were some surgeons where I felt they saw me as a literally just a brain, and I'm sure they do a great job. But for me, it was essential to be taken on the journey and to say, yeah, this is where you are in your Parkinson's journey right now. Let's see how many steps forward we can go together to make this work, to make this a less terrible burden, I suppose. And I don't know if you would agree. I think patient centricity is becoming a huge topic. And I'm delighted to see it finally getting to where it should be, namely right in the middle of any surgery or any type of interaction with people with Parkinson's. Has that changed? I mean, you've been doing this longer than I have, so to speak. Is that a positive change that you would say has come about in the community of neurosurgery and particularly deep brain stimulation?
I guess it is a change that has happened. But to be honest, I think for a long time, I think many clinicians have understood and been committed to putting the patient at the center. I think we probably talk about it more now, but I know some of my predecessors, people I worked with, I was trained by, they genuinely had this approach. They may not have verbalized it in the same way that we do now, but certainly they practice it. But clearly it is very important to verbalize it. And, you know, it's great to have good intention, but if you don't communicate this with others, they may not perceive that. So I think it's very important to talk about it and to also reassure the patients that really what we do is for them. I mean, I can't think of any other reason to do the kind of things that we do unless we got the best of patients at heart. So Kathy, you mentioned that you were diagnosed with Parkinson's disease about 10 years ago or so now. Can you just please tell us, what are your initial symptoms? How did they change over the last decade? And eventually, at what stage did you decide to go ahead for deep brain stimulation, which I understand was about just over a year ago or so?
That's right, KMRs. Well, my first and always most bothersome symptom was a tremor. So my husband actually first noticed it. He said, you know, when we go for a walk and I hold your hand, it's like there's a bit of electricity running through your hand, a very slight shake. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I'll go and I'll ask my GP next time I'm there. and was at my GP's for, I don't know, a cold or something, I think, and said, by the way, my husband says, and the GP said, well, would you mind doing a few, you know, little tests for me? And he had me do the classic thing of pretending to change a light bulb, you know, where you have to move your hand in a certain way. And kind of face got more and more concerned. And he said, well, I don't mean to alarm you, but you might want to go to a neurologist. Now, I don't think anybody can say the sentence, not alarm you and go to a neurologist in the same breath. So duly alarmed, off I went, was diagnosed fairly quickly. And I think in the beginning, as with all patients, you know, you're told, okay, you've got this disease, it's chronic, it's not going away. You take your medicine and you kind of digest for a while. And then I wanted to look into what the future would hold, and I started to research. So I saw that deep brain stimulation is an option for some patients. And it was always the tremor that remained my main problem. You know, at some stage, if I had to go up to the bar and carry two glasses of Guinness or two glasses of wine back down, I'd have to go twice because the glass in my right hand would have shaken so much that half the drink would have been spilled. Or trying putting on nail polish or putting in an earring when your hand is shaking that badly, you know. So it just became quite debilitating, and it was obviously very noticeable, which led to me needing to tell people, which I'm very glad I did. And I would encourage people to tell people if they can. It's a very liberating experience. Everybody was wonderful. And I think I always had deep brain stimulation in the back of my mind as a kind of an insurance policy, saying, okay, when things kind of start to get really annoying, I look into it. And I'd always read, and Kay Mars, maybe you can comment on this, that tremor dominant Parkinson's reacts best, or at least is easier as a target for deep brain stimulation. So, you know, when the tremor started to get worse, I'd say maybe 7 years into diagnosis, I started to really think about it, started to talk to my family. And 8 years in, I was like, yeah, I've had enough of this. I want to be able to carry two drinks down from the bar. I want to be able to put on my makeup. I want to, you know, I just want to feel more normal. And that's when I started to have the conversation. So would I be right in saying that, Kay Mars, that tremor dominant is, it's, I know you can also treat stiffness, etc. with DBS, but I think tremor dominant is easier. Is that correct?
Yes, Kathy, you're quite right. So there's a whole range of symptoms that we know respond really well to deep brain stimulation. So with respect to tremor, what is interesting about tremor is that it is one of those symptoms that tend not to respond very well to medication. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if your number one problem is tremor, and if it's difficult to treat this with medication, as often is, then, you know, deep brain stimulation has a real role to play here, and we can get really good outcome with patients with tremor. As you mentioned, you may not be able to feed yourself or hold a cup or a glass of water, and this is obviously incredibly disabling and also socially quite difficult as well. I know many of patients with Parkinson's disease and tremor just don't want to go out. They don't want to go to a restaurant because find it quite difficult. Mm. But as you also alluded to, tremor is not the only symptom that responds very well to deep brain stimulation. So as you know, two of the other so-called cardinal symptoms of Parkinson's disease are stiffness, so-called rigidity, so the muscles are quite hard and stiff, and also what we call bradykinesia, which is a fancy term for slowness of the movement. So movements become quite slow. Again, both of those conditions, although they initially can respond fairly well with medication, long-term that response can be difficult, and again, they can respond really well to deep brain stimulation. And really, the last set of symptoms that respond really well to deep brain stimulations are those symptoms which are not because of Parkinson's disease at all. They are due to the side effects of medications that people have to take for Parkinson's disease. So conditions like dyskinesias, which is a difficult term, but it really means all those exaggerated movements that can sometimes be very severe. So very different from tremor, which is a rhythmic movement, if you like. The dyskinesias are, you know, can be much more pronounced. And again, that can be quite socially difficult to handle, and also can sometimes be painful and uncomfortable. And then you have these exaggerated added movements. Of course, there are conditions like fluctuations. So, you know, many patients with Parkinson's disease, they tend not to have a steady day. They go between the states of being what we call off, so lots of stiffness, tremor, etc., and the states of being very on with dyskinesia, with all these extra movements. So the day is a bit of like a yo-yo for them, you know, up and down, up and down. Again, that can be made much more smooth with deep brain stimulation, which works continuously 24/7. So those are the main indications. Although, if I can go on a little bit longer, we've done some work looking at other, what we call non-motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease, because we nowadays know Parkinson's disease is not just about movement. There are lots of other non-movement related symptoms. And there's evidence that these can also be improved.
I think, Amos, it's all about quality of life when it comes down to it. I mean, the fact that I had brain surgery is not going to change the course of my progression as such. I'm very much aware of that. Although I would argue that because one can do more sport and is more active after the operation due to the symptoms being less, it is actually disease modifying in that you can do more that's good for you afterwards. At least I can. I can definitely do sport and be active. And I know that's a huge factor in keeping Parkinson's, at least if not at bay, then slightly better under control. But I suppose what I really would like to emphasize is what you said before as well, okay, Mars, about the social interaction aspect of it, you know, and that was a big factor for me leading up to the decision to have deep brain stimulation. It was, you know, I didn't hide. I did go out to restaurants, but I was very aware of the fact that I would consciously not order a steak in a restaurant, even if I wanted to, because just cutting a steak with my right hand would be so painful and so awkward in company as well that I just didn't do it. You know, I'd rather order maybe a risotto, because you could eat that with your left hand with the fork. So it's tiny things. It's you know, people I think don't realize how much gets taken away from you with the Parkinson's diagnosis and how much you find ways to adapt within yourself. And for me, the decision to take DBS was, I think, a way of just saying, you know, I want to regain some of the skills that I use, some of the fine motor skills that I used to have, and just buy myself an extra 5 or 10 years.
You're listening to episode 10 of series 2 of the Parkinson's Life podcast with Kathy and Kiomars, funded by Medtronic. Be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform to hear more from the series.
Obviously, making a decision to have surgery, deep brain stimulation, is a very big undertaking. So just tell me, what were your fears, your thoughts when you're making the decision, the sort of how you're balancing whether to go ahead for the surgery or not?
Well, listen, you know, I think any surgery that you go in for, they sit you down, they're like, well, these are the possible, you know, side effects up to and including death. And when you're having your appendix out, you don't really, at least I didn't listen to them. I was like, yeah, whatever, highly unlikely. And when you're going in for brain surgery, you listen a bit more carefully because you realize, you know, things can go wrong. On the other hand, this is going to sound crazy, but I wasn't terribly afraid of the operation. My husband was absolutely terrified. God help him. You know, he was waiting at home for the call that everything was okay. It was done in COVID times, so nobody could be with me. I was, for some reason, relatively confident. Now, I did think a lot about it, and I spoke to my family and I spoke to my kids and I said, listen, there is a risk. And they were like, go for it, Mum. You know, it's all going to be okay. So I suppose you could call me an eternal optimist or an absolute idiot or something in between. But fear wasn't my main issue. Now, I did think a lot about the fact that you have to be awake for the operation. I think that is a huge factor for a lot of people leading up to the decision because, Kmart, I'm sure you can explain this a bit better, why being awake is a good idea and what you tell people about that part of the operation. But for me, that was a factor. But again, I said to myself, listen, it's going to be one tough day. They're going to have it under control. I'm in Germany. I'm with great doctors. And I think it is a huge privilege that we have in the Western world. And one that I'm very aware that I'm privileged to have is that I do have good, safe hospitals at my disposal. And I have the choice to have this operation in the first place. So I think I looked at it like I'm one of the lucky ones who can do this, who is suitable, who lives in a country where this is offered. I'm just going to bloody well do it and hope for the best. I know a lot of people do, you know, really lie awake at night beforehand. And I only got really scared, I think, the morning of the surgery, because I had to wait in pre-op for an hour. They kind of forgot about me. Well, they didn't forget about me. That sounds awful, but there was a hiccup in the scheduling, and I was in pre-op in my operation gown for an hour with nothing to do but wait. And it was then that I started to go like, what am I doing here? Am I insane? Before that, I was reasonably calm and I think primarily hopeful KMRs. I don't know if that's classic or, you know, what do you say to people when you're saying, well, yes, we can do the surgery, but by the way, you need to be awake.
No, absolutely. So, I mean, let me just step back a little bit and just reemphasize some of the points you made. So clearly it's a very big undertaking. It's a life-changing step in the course of the Parkinson's disease. It's a big deal for anybody, as you said, having surgery, especially on the brain. So this is a very big thing. And I think it would be strange or weird if patients didn't feel anxious. I think I worry about the patient who doesn't feel anxious about having surgery. So that's a good, healthy thing. And I think our job as clinicians is to reassure them in a realistic fashion. It's not to hide the facts from them. It's not to hide their risks from them, but to reassure them and try to put those risks in the context of the benefit that can be gained from the surgery. And I think one of the key factors that automatically establish that confidence is repetition. So repetition is a very good thing. So for example, in King's College Hospital where I work, we got a very set process for assessment, which inherently means that patients have to come and see multiple members of a team, hear the story from different mouths in different ways, until the foodie can see all the angles involved. So this is very good. I mean, so I'm not a big advocate of a surgeon, of the patient coming to see the surgeon, and that's it. You see one face, you get one version of the facts, and then you go ahead. I think that's not good for anybody. In our service, therefore, for example, the way we run this is they initially don't see me at all. They see the neurologist part of my DBS team. So we've got a very, very lucky big teaching hospital, obviously. So we've got lots of team members. So patients start off once they get referred, and the first person they see is our DBS neurologist. So that's a neurologist who subspecializes not only in movement disorders, but in movement disorders treated with deep brain stimulation. So super, super specialist, if you like. So once they see him, and if in principle they're happy to go ahead, then they get to see our neuropsychologist, who will assess the neuropsychological side. But again, explains the process. So another person explaining what's happening. Then they see the neuropsychiatrist. That's another person. So far, three people I've seen, each one of them discussing different aspects of this therapy. Each one of them explaining more, hopefully relieving some of the anxieties, clarifying some misconceptions, and also telling the facts. Then they also see the clinical nurse specialist for a whole lot of tests that we do as prerequisite for patient selection. And only after that, and only after we have all discussed the patient in our multidisciplinary team meeting, so neurologists present their findings, psychologists present their findings, psychiatrist does the same thing, clinical nurse specialist shows the data. After all that, and during that meeting, if we are deciding that we're going ahead, only then the patient sees me. So by the time I get to see the surgeon, I've seen four other specialists already. So huge amount of information. I've had time to digest. I've had time to think about questions. So it's not just one-stop shop. So when they see me, actually, the hard work is already done by my team. So for me, it's easy. Patients know a lot already. So I just clarify those final points and address those questions and try to sort of put their mind at rest. Not talking about awake surgery specifically, because you asked me how you talk to patients about awake surgery. So in some ways, I'll put things in context exactly like you did. So yes, it is potentially a scary day, but if you think about a lifetime of benefits, most people are happy to put that into context. But also, I need to also say this. It is not as if we cannot do deep brain stimulation under general anesthetic. We can. I mean, you know, we can achieve good results under general anesthetic. But proof of the pudding is to fine-tune it with the patient awake. So if you have got a patient who is genuinely unable to have awake surgery because they're claustrophobic and have got severe back pain so they cannot lie flat on the bed, we can still offer them a surgery. So it's not to exclude them from surgery. So we can still achieve good results. But to my mind, if the patients are happy to face awake surgery for a few hours, then we potentially can give them extra benefits.
You just spoke about the fact that it kind of serves as insurance, I suppose, for both the surgeon and the person undergoing surgery. And for me, that point that you just made, KMRs, was a really important one in the decision to go ahead and have surgery. I knew that I would be awake. Yes, I was, you know, I had a lot of respect for the thought of lying on the table awake during this procedure. But for me, it was a huge relief to know I wouldn't wake up and find that something had gone wrong. You know, if something goes wrong, then I would have known about it. And there was a point, and maybe you can elaborate on exactly how this works, but I do remember a point during surgery, you know, when they were placing the electrodes and they were getting me to say the days of the week in German all the time. And so, you know, so far so good. I was saying my Montag, Dienstag, Mittwoch, and suddenly I couldn't say the days of the week well at all. I was suddenly going, it was a really freaky experience. And then they're like, okay, everybody, no worries. You know, we'll just reposition. And then I was able to talk again.
When we do the surgery awake, really for two main reasons. One is to optimize the benefits, and the other is to minimize the risks. So we're looking to have the best outcome clinically. So you want to see the best improvement in tremor, slowness of the movements, stiffness, all those things that you cannot assess if the patient sleeps. So that's very important. Equally, we're looking for side effects because there's no point improving your movements, but your speech is getting affected. So clearly, we don't want that. So again, the only way to be sure about those is by actually having the patient, you know, awake on the table, examining them, interacting with them, talking to them. So when they were asking you to count words, they were assessing two different things. They were checking your speech, but they were also checking your cognition to make sure that you remember the day. So the multiple aspects were assessing. You know, when they examine your eyes, they're looking to see whether, you know, there's an interruption, double vision, for example. So very important to make sure all those side effects are absolutely minimized. And to my mind, I feel happier when I can test the patient awake on the table.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, we've talked a lot of detail already about my experience and how you go about it. But when it comes down to it, KMRs, what is DBS exactly? Like what's going on in my, what's happening in my brain right now? I've got two electrodes. You can't see the bumps, but I've got, you know, my little scars up here in my head. I know I've got electrodes in my brain. What's going on in my head right now?
So Kathy, the question, what is deep brain stimulation, is fairly easy to answer. The question, how does deep brain stimulation work, is impossible to answer, right? So let me take the easy question. So deep brain stimulation, as we said before, is a subtype of what we call functional neurosurgery. So functional neurosurgery is operating on the brain to change the function of the brain. Because remember, usually when traditionally when people do surgery, they change the structure, right? They do appendicectomy, they take the appendix out, or they do bypass grafting in the heart and they put some veins here and there. So it's a structural modification of the body that you achieve. In functional neurosurgery, we're not after the structure. What you want to do is to correct the abnormal function. So that's what deep brain stimulation is. And it achieves its overall effect by through inserting one or two electrodes deep inside the brain to at very specific locations. So it's very target driven. So you have to have a target. It's not as if you just put electrodes in and hope for the best. You have to have a specific target that you work out on based on patient symptoms and whole lot of other things. So those electrodes go to the target, specific targets, and they are the means that you deliver the electricity to those parts of the brain. And in order for those electrodes to be empowered, they're connected to a battery pacemaker, which is a generator. So the system typically is one or two electrodes connected to a couple of cables, which are then connected to a battery pacemaker. So this is what deep brain stimulation is. And of course, the system is permanently implanted. So it's there inside you and chronically and continuously most often just works. So that's what deep brain stimulation is. Now, how does it work is incredibly difficult to answer. But to be honest, it is impossible to know exactly how it works, and it's very lucky that it works differently. But you know what? I don't really understand how the electricity works, but I know if I press the little button on the, you know, on the wall, I can turn the electricity on. And as long as we know it works and it's effective, I love to understand the science, but that's not necessary as long as we know it works, I think.
It's so funny, you know, it confirms what I've heard and read so often. And in a way, it's mind-boggling to think I agreed to have surgery where everybody says we know that it works, we just don't know how. But bottom line, KMRs, you're absolutely right. You know, I don't know a lot of things, but I know they're there and I know they work. And I know that for me, when I had the surgery and they turned on the electricity and my tremor pretty much disappeared, That was the magic moment. How it exactly happens, I think it would be great if we understand more, because we'll understand the brain better and what's going on. But for me and for anybody thinking about having DBS, I think my main advice would be don't overthink, because, you know, for me, it's the proof of the pudding, and thousands of people have been helped by this, you know, procedure, and thousands more will be helped. And I know DBS is developing all the time as well. I know there's adaptive DBS now, which somebody I know in America has just had done, where my understanding is that the electricity, so to speak, or the signal given in the brain adapts to when it's actually needed. I'm not quite sure if that's correct, but, you know, I know there's a lot happening in DBS and in brain surgery in general. So I'm just grateful that it does work.
So, Kathy, just going back to when you had your deep brain stimulation, do you remember what kind of preparations you had to make ahead of the surgery?
Well, it was very, very much like what you described, KMRs. I had to see a whole range of specialists. I went up to Lübeck, where I had the operation done, and was assessed over the course of, I can't remember, I think it was 3 or 4, maybe even 5 days, various cognitive tests, and the standard, you know, making sure my heart was okay for surgery, all that kind of stuff. The only thing that I didn't have that you mentioned was a psychologist. Now, I do find that very useful. I think I would say it's a step that I would like to see taken in the future. So I had cognitive testing to make sure that my progression of Parkinson's wasn't such that the cognitive decline had meant that I wouldn't benefit from DBS. At least that was my understanding. But I was not assessed by somebody who said, listen, she's not going to entirely freak out during the experience, or, you know, whatever people assess you for, or she doesn't have any hidden trauma that may affect the outcome of the operation. And I think that would be something, you know, we're realizing, you coming back to something you said right at the earlier on, Kaymore, about the mind and the body working together. I think we're only beginning to understand what things like trauma and people's experiences do to their bodies. So I think having a psychologist assess a person is a very good step, and one I would like to see implemented in future, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, we've been lucky in our service from day one. We've had both a neuropsychologist and a neuropsychiatrist, so both assessing all our patients. So the role of neuropsychologist, as you said, is to perform cognitive testing and understand if there's any cognitive decline, but also assessing much more beyond that. And again, giving an extra dimension to the patients about what the surgery entails. And the role of neuropsychiatry is equally important, and they look at not the cognition as such, but the mood, because we know that, for example, many patients with Parkinson's disease can have mood problems. It's not to say that if you've got a mood problem, you cannot be a candidate for surgery, but what we do say, if there's a mood problem, let's treat it first to optimize your chance of doing well with the surgery. And again, some patients can have mood problems even with DBS in situ long term. And again, it's good to have somebody who's seen them before, knows them well, and has assessed them before, who can follow through them. So I think both the neuropsychologists and neuropsychiatrists are quite useful people to have as part of your team. And I certainly have been a great advocate of both those two members to be very active in our team.
Yeah. You know, and apart from that, the preparation was fairly easy, I suppose. I would say it was down to me to say, yeah, I want to do this, and to say I'm 100% sure. And I think that comes back to sitting down with family, with whoever you want to talk to through these things about. I think it is essential that people do discuss the implications of the operation and whether they want to have it, because it's only when you talk about it that you can articulate your own feelings for it. But for me, having the full support, you know, of my family, if my husband had said, please don't do it, I'm terrified that you'll die, it would have been a big burden for me. And the fact that he said, no, hey, listen, go for it, it's going to be cool, it's going to be great, do it, was a huge help for me. And, you know, other than that, there were no major challenges. Yes, I did have to go off, if I remember correctly, I had to go reduce the dopamine agonist that I was taking before the operation, but that didn't significantly impact my symptoms. I felt that that wasn't too burdensome. And I suppose for me, the most burdensome aspect was something that hopefully someday will be a thing of the past, was that I was having the operation in COVID times. So I was allowed no visitors. I had to be swabbed. It was before the vaccinations had been had come out. So that was tough, doing it on my own. A very good friend was allowed to come and visit me unexpectedly that morning, which was so wonderful for me. The hospital said, "We've changed our policy. You're allowed to have one visitor." And she got literally got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get in her car and come and hold my hand for half an hour. That was so wonderful of her. But otherwise, I was alone, and that was tough. So I'm hoping that that particular aspect of being operated on for whatever reason will soon be a thing of the past. We'll see. But, you know, I think it emphasizes, and Kaymore, as you might be able to comment on this as well, how important a support network is for people surrounding this operation. You know, after the operation, I felt surprisingly fit quite quickly. But I think psychologically, it's a lot to deal with, and I think people just need people around them.
Yeah, 100%. So as you rightly say, compared to other neurosurgical operations, this is not a kind of operation you need weeks and weeks or months of recovery. So recovery from physical sense is rather quick, but recovery is not just about the physical side, as you just mentioned, and the whole emotional side of things. Big life event is very important, and 100% right, having a good network of family and friends to support you is absolutely crucial. And I think that's 100%. I'm really glad to hear that you had your friend coming to see you. I think that would have been a really positive step for you. So, Kathy, you mentioned that one of your friends had deep brain stimulation. Just tell me, to what extent did that influence your decision to have the surgery?
It was a huge help. It was somebody I met through the Parkinson's Network. He was introduced to me by a friend that we have in common. And to see the success of that operation and to hear from him, you know, yeah, it's great. My symptoms have improved by, I don't know what he said, but he said it was life-changing. And the words life-changing for me were, yeah, there we go. That's it. I'm not going to get that from, you know, swallowing a tablet of levodopa for the next few years. I wanted something more radical. I just wanted to disrupt Parkinson's as best I could. And for me, this was the way to do it. And this friend of mine, Peter, was a huge help and a huge comfort for me in knowing that he had gone through the same operation in the same hospital. You know, he recommended the team. He was the reason I went to Lübeck, which is, 600 kilometers away. I think in general, the Parkinson's Network, the people who are out there who are affiliated with Parkinson's in some way, they're an incredible, amazing bunch of people. And I can only encourage anybody who's newly diagnosed or looking for answers to get active in their Parkinson's community, because people are wonderful. And it's one thing that Parkinson's has given me, it's taken away a lot, but it has given me incredible friends and a spectacular network that you can rely on for information, for encouragement, for joking around, for everything, you know. And in the run-up to surgery, I asked a lot of questions and got a lot of answers. I didn't research myself to death. I think you can do too much homework as well. So I did as much homework as I felt comfortable with. I talked to the people I knew who'd had the procedure, who were all happy with it. I know there are occasional stories where it's not perfect, and I think we mustn't ignore those. There are cases where the result is not as it's hoped for, but in my case and in the case of my good friend Peter, it was great and absolutely was a huge encouragement to me to actually go ahead with the procedure, you know. Kaymore, I'd love your opinion on this. You know, there's, when I started looking into this and I saw that brain surgery was an option, I was like, okay, but that's an option like when I'm old, when I can't go on anymore, when maybe I've had Parkinson's for 20 years, 30 years. And then I did more research, and what I saw really convinced me to do it rather earlier than later, in that if you can get those good, say, 5 or 10 years of life, why not now at this end of the scale? You know, for me, it was a big thing to say, I'm not 50 yet, and I don't want to feel like an 80-year-old on my 50th birthday. So when can people have DBS? Can anybody have it? Is it age group specific? You know, how do you recommend to people when to take this step on the journey?
Sure. That's an excellent question, Kathy. And my answer is rather simple. I think we need to move away from numbers. I think numbers won't help anybody. I think the time to think about DBS is when you consider your treatment, your medical treatment, not sufficient to give the quality of life that you want. So it's a matter of what it is that you want in your life and quality of life. And if your medical management is no longer able to give that to you, that's the time to think about surgery. So you're absolutely right. Very often we get patients referred to us who've had Parkinson's disease 15, 20 years down the line. And unfortunately, many of these patients have already lost a huge amount of quality of life. And to be honest, I don't like to think about DBS as a last resort. It's definitely not a last resort option. It's an option to give you the best quality of life for as long as possible. And therefore, if you leave the patients until they have very little left in terms of quality of life, I can't see to what extent DBS is going to help them. So there are studies out there. And in fact, there's a very good paper published from German group, so you can probably read it in the original language. Having said that, it was published in English, called the Early STEM Study, who looked at when is the optimal time to operate. And what they found was that at 5 years or so, perhaps patients should at least know about deep brain stimulation, because there are a lot of patients out there that 5 years down the line from medical management, they begin to run into what we call side effects of that medical management. Things like fluctuation we mentioned before, for example, or dyskinesias. And when you have those so-called motor complications, that's the time to think about DBS, because as I mentioned to you before, DBS not only improves a whole lot of symptoms in Parkinson's disease, also improves those symptoms which are due to the medical management, due to the side effects of medications. So in my practice, what I advocate is not to force anybody to have DBS early, but at least patients should be aware, maybe at 5 years down the line from diagnosis, that there is a surgical option. So as long as I've got the awareness, they have the choice and they can make that decision. What we shouldn't be doing as clinicians is to, you know, have this paternalistic view that we are in charge and I'm going to tell you when you have a choice. I'm going to tell you when you don't have a choice. That's not our role. Our role is to give the patients the options, and it's for the patients to choose what's the right way. So we give the information, they make a decision. And I think at 5 years down the line, there is sufficient burden that patients should at least know there is an alternative to the medical management. If they chose to go ahead, they can see the surgeon, go through the process, and potentially be a candidate. If not, at least they have known about this.
I can totally relate to that, Kemos. I think for me, the moment came when I realized I was waking up every day and Parkinson's was the first thought or one of the first thoughts on my mind, because it just wasn't, you couldn't escape it anymore. And then to have the option to say, you know, I don't want that. I want life to be full of other things and not just Parkinson's. And Parkinson's will, unfortunately, probably always be part of my life unless somebody out there calling all takers comes up with a miracle. But I think the choice to have DBS is about waking up in the morning and having the option of not being your first thought of the day for a while. And it gave me that choice, that option. And it's not the right path for everybody. And I know it's not successful for everybody, but to have it on the list of options was for me a super important part of my Parkinson's journey. And I can only hope that more clever minds come up with more options for us, you know.
Thank you, Kathy. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you, to hear your journey, to hear your story, to hear how well you've done. I'm so pleased. There's nothing more gratifying for a doctor to see a patient doing well ever. So really good to see you, and keep up your good work, carry on advocating, and I'm sure I'll see you again, but lovely to meet you.
Kemos, it's been so great to talk to you. I hope this is of interest and helpful to people. It's certainly for me to really sit down with somebody and really just talk through has been really interesting. Lovely to talk to you, and yeah, keep on changing the world in your everyday work.
Thanks for listening to the Parkinson's Life podcast. If you like what you've heard, please rate and review. It helps make sure others can find us. And if you'd like to share your story with Parkinson's Life, get in touch through Facebook, Twitter, or by emailing editor@parkinsonslife.eu. Keep a lookout for our next episode, and until then, take care.